Welcome to Trust Me, the official podcast of the Trust and Estate Section of the California Lawyers Association. The Trust and Estate Section seeks to further the knowledge of practitioners through updates and a wide range of educational opportunities. In addition, the section monitors and participates in the formation of laws and regulations that impact the trust and estates field and represents section members in the governance of the California Lawyers Association. For further information about the Trust and Estate Section, please go to calawyers.org, click on Sections, Trusts and Estates to learn about upcoming educational opportunities and the benefits of section membership. And now, to your host of today's podcast.
My guests for today's episode are Scott Frazier and Matt Owens, authors of an article to be published in the Trust and Estates Quarterly entitled, Let's Get Digital, ESI and Trust and Estate Litigation. In our discussion, we cover the ethical duties of attorneys in regard to e-discovery. We talk about preservation letters to clients and opposing counsel and common sources of electronically stored information, or ESI. We learn what native format and metadata mean and under what circumstances you might request one or the other or both. Finally, we talk about how to sift through mountains of ESI to find the relevant information, as well as addressing privacy concerns related to production of ESI. Scott and Matt's article is a must-read for all trust and estate practitioners, whether you do litigation, planning, or administration. Today's episode will be eye-opening to those who have not yet dealt extensively with ESI issues in their practice. So here's my conversation with Scott and Matt. Well, with me today is Scott Frazier and Matt Owens. Scott, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Thank you, Herb. Like you said, my name is Scott Frazier. I'm an attorney at Crist, Bjorn, Shepard, and Roshkoff in Palo Alto, California. I've been in practice for about 10 years. About 50% of my practice is devoted to trust and estate litigation, and the other 50% is devoted to estate planning and administration for high net worth individuals.
Great. Matt, how about you?
So I am a partner at the law firm of Withers in its San Diego office. I've been in practice for about 10 years as well. Scott and I happened to go to law school together and overlapped at Santa Clara. I do exclusively trust and estate litigation and have for my whole practice, certified specialist in this practice area, although I don't recall any ESI questions on that exam. So, that's a little bit about my practice.
I invited you to Trust Me to talk about your upcoming article coming out in the Trust and Estates Quarterly entitled, Let's Get Digital, ESI and Trust and Estate Litigation. It looks like the article will appear in volume 27, issue 2 of the Quarterly, and probably hit mailboxes around July of this year. So what prompted you guys to write an article about ESI in the first place?
So Scott and I were interested in doing an article together, and we're talking about some topics along these lines. And I think, Scott, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in our conversation about ESI as a potential topic for an article, Scott said something to the effect of, hey, it'd be nice if opposing counsel would stop looking at me like I had two heads every time I wanted ESI. And I said, yeah, that's been consistent with my experience too. And, you know, it really feels like the civil litigators have all sort of jumped on this train long ago, and some T&E litigators, not all, but some kind of get left behind. And it'd be nice if we could, you know, try to normalize ESI and trust and estate litigation a little bit. And so Scott can tell me if I'm off the rails on that quote or something close to that quote, but that was what got the conversation going, got us interested in doing an article on this.
Yeah, no, and that's absolutely correct. And I think part of it too is that, you know, a lot of the literature or the, you know, secondary sources that are out there that have to do with ESI concern, you know, big law, large scale litigation. And there isn't a lot out there that addresses the sources of ESI that we deal with in trust and estate litigation. And so hopefully we can start that dialectic.
Yeah, I think civil litigators have been dealing with e-discovery issues for a while. I think trust and estate practitioners were kind of late to the party on this stuff. You use the term ESI. Let's assume, and it's an easy assumption for me, let's assume we don't know much about these topics. What do you mean by ESI?
And so what we mean by that is just electronically stored information. And the definition for that is given in the Code of Civil Procedure. And it basically means any information that is stored electronically in any different kind of medium. So given all the different kinds of electronic devices that we use, the definition is potentially limitless.
In your article, one of the things you start out with is discussing the ethical duties of attorneys in regard to e-discovery. What kind of ethical duties are we looking at for e-discovery?
And there's actually a California State Bar opinion that specifically addresses attorney competence in e-discovery, and that says that at a minimum, attorneys in litigation have to have a basic understanding of the discovery of electronically stored information. And they give kind of a laundry list of items, and it essentially boils down to you have to be able to identify potential sources of ESI in the litigation. You have to be able to advise your own client on how to preserve their electronically stored information. And you have to be able to collect electronically stored information and request it from the other side, and to be able to meet and confer competently with opposing counsel on this. And this really is a sliding scale. Depending on the type of ESI in each case, your duty of competence might be a little bit higher than that. An attorney that lacking competence has three options. They can acquire it themselves, they can associate counsel or consult with technical consultants, or they can decline the representation.
What are the most common issues? If I'm a trust and estate litigator, what are the common areas where I'm going to need to know background in ESI and e-discovery? What are the kind of issues that I should be worried about?
Let me approach that just based on sort of the category of data or device that you'd be dealing with. And this might be when you're either seeking discovery, seeking ESI, or responding to someone's request. In our practice as trust and estate litigators, what you're dealing with a lot in this context would be trying to get native format emails and other common file types like Word documents, Excel spreadsheets. But really, emails are the big one in terms of file types. You want to be able to know how to request the right type of email in the right format, whether it's native or near native. And then also thinking about the devices that come up a lot in our practice. So it would be perhaps a decedent's laptop or the decedent's phone. Those devices could also have the emails on them as well, so you might have some overlap there if the emails are also on the devices. But those are the common areas where this comes up. Trying to get native versions of common file types such as emails, and then knowing how to properly request and then search the common devices like laptops and decedent's phone. That's usually the gold mine of data is the laptop and the phone.
Let me unpack that a little bit. What do you mean by native?
So native would be the actual file type as it sits on the responding party's device. So if it's a Word document, for example, then it's going to be the .doc file. If it's an email, then it would be the actual email file. And then the reason you kind of want that is if you get it in its native format, it carries with it all of the metadata that you might need to be able to properly evaluate that particular piece of evidence. And that would include things like date that it was created, date that it was edited, who created it, things of that nature. If you don't get native, and let's say you go to the other extreme where you're just getting a paper copy of this discovery, obviously you're not getting any of that metadata. So you might be able to look at the piece of paper and see a date written on it, but you're going to lose a whole lot of information that you would be able to get from the native by looking at the metadata. You can see if it was changed over time, see who changed it, you know, when it was changed, and all of that could be really important.
So as the practicing attorney, what should I be thinking about when I'm going, when I do some planning for e-discovery?
So one of the things that we try to do in the article is try to provide a checklist of potential sources of ESI that you can run through. Ultimately, the different sources of electronically stored information are going to be determined by the parties who are involved in the litigation. It's possible to think of a decedent who never used a computer, never used a cell phone, and in that case, you're not going to have very much. On the other extreme, we can think of someone who use it in every facet of their everyday life. And in that case, there's going to be all different kinds of sources of e-discovery that you can look at. And so part of it is just running through a checklist for yourself and trying to think of the different things that are out there that you might be able to use in your case.
You get into preservation of e-discovery. Can you talk about that a little bit? First of all, what kind of duties do I have if I represent the fiduciary? What should I be alerting my client to?
First, I'll say, when does this duty trigger? Because that's important to have in mind. When do you actually have this duty? And it's when you reasonably anticipate litigation. So if litigation's already filed by the time the client comes to you, then of course, you know, this duty has been triggered because there's pending litigation. But even short of the filing of a lawsuit, depending on the circumstances, you might reasonably anticipate, you know, there's some sort of demand made, there's some sort of threat of litigation, and you can see that the train's coming down the tracks. And so as soon as you reasonably anticipate litigation, or if it's already been filed, then you have the duty to preserve. And what that's going to mean is you need to be, as the attorney, advising your client on how to go about preserving information. And that might require that they do very little. It might require that they just hold the devices, they don't delete anything, they don't throw anything away. But it might also require affirmative steps. For example, if an email account is going to be sought, you know, emails from an email account is going to be sought in discovery, or you anticipate that that's a possibility. A lot of email accounts have an auto delete function. After a certain period of time, the sort of system will go ahead based on the settings and just delete older emails. And sometimes those time frames are pretty short. So as attorneys, we want to advise our clients to turn that feature off, so that those emails are not getting auto-deleted. And so there are instances like that where you would need to take affirmative steps to make sure that evidence is not destroyed or made unavailable. But for the most part, it's just telling your clients, maintain status quo, keep everything available, don't mess with anything or change anything, because it's either being requested or it might be requested at some point in the future. Herb, if it's helpful, I can give an example on that point.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
Yeah, so I had a case a couple years ago where the personal representative of an estate had possession of the decedent's laptop. And the personal representative's view was, based on statements that were purportedly made to this personal representative by the decedent, the thought was the decedent would want the laptop destroyed. And so this personal representative actually destroyed the laptop by having a big bonfire in her backyard, threw the laptop in.
Oh boy.
Yeah, exactly. and destroyed the laptop that way. Now, the decedent did not say in his will that he wanted his laptop destroyed. There was no, you know, writing that could be pointed to from the decedent himself saying, I want this thing destroyed. But that was the personal representative's position. In that particular instance, there was litigation. It happened to occur after the burning of the laptop, and probably so far after the burning of the laptop that would not be considered spoliation of evidence, because the personal rep in that situation could argue that she did not, at the time she burned it, reasonably anticipate litigation. And we never got a decision from a judge on that because we didn't get to trial in that particular case. But if you change the facts just a little bit and say, okay, let's say she burned the laptop after, let's say, a threat of litigation had been made, then you potentially have catastrophic consequences where you could potentially seek terminating sanctions for destruction of evidence, because that duty to preserve would have been triggered if this person had reasonably anticipated litigation, and destroying a laptop and the trove of information that could have potentially been on it could have resulted in severe sanctions, all the way up to potentially terminating sanctions. I mean, that would be the extreme. So, you know, you more likely might be getting issue or evidence sanctions as a result of that. But, you know, in theory, terminating sanctions could be sought for something like that. So really important to tell your clients, don't burn things in a bonfire and don't destroy evidence as soon as you reasonably anticipate litigation.
I see in the article you have a very thorough evidence preservation letter as a sample there. Do you regularly send those out when you start any kind of trust litigation?
In that excerpt that we've got in the article is sort of an abbreviated version of what I typically send out, and so attorneys might want to add, and you know, their own bells and whistles. And you know, if you look at the article and you want to send me an email and tell me all the things that I should have put in there that I didn't, I'd welcome that. But but yeah, that's something I commonly send. So I send that letter to opposing counsel that says, hey, lawsuit's been filed or lawsuit's reasonably anticipated, now you got a duty to preserve, and I spell out some examples of things that need to be preserved. So I send that to opposing counsel. I also send it to my client, and I want the client to also know, hey, you have this duty to preserve as well. And it's good to give the client a heads up before you send that letter so they don't feel like you're accusing them of potentially destroying evidence. But it's important that you clearly spell out for them, you know, your own client, spell out for them their obligations to preserve evidence too.
Yeah, I think that is especially important if you're representing the trustee, for instance, or anyone that's potentially has, like you said, that the decedents, I can see a fiduciary, maybe it's one of the kids, and they say, well, dad's phone, you know, I'll just give it away, I'll donate it, I'll destroy it. Things that would make sense, except that they are potential sources of evidence. So if you're initiating the litigation, and say you're the petitioner contesting the trust or the will, would you start with some kind of a meet and confer process? I know we're all familiar with that with just in general discovery, but a meet and confer that's oriented towards e-discovery.
Yeah, absolutely. And so under the federal rules, there's a meet and confer requirement as just part of the regular meet and confer issues. And you need to meet and confer and discuss the different kinds of ESI that are out there. California law largely borrows from federal law, and I think that it's definitely a good practice to have that conversation with opposing counsel. One of the big themes of our article is that you need to plan your e-discovery early. You essentially get one shot at your requests. They can be so expensive and time-consuming that courts are reluctant to let you kind of come back and say, wait a minute, no, I actually wanted to request X instead of Y. You really do need to try to get those requests right the first time. And the best way to do that is to meet and confer early and often.
Okay. Yeah, you had an example of a case where somebody didn't ask the right things and they got shut down. What was that one about?
That had to do with, I believe, requests for metadata, and which is essentially data about data. Using Matt's example as a Word document, there's the data that we can see, which is the actual text, but there are other layers of data in that file, which is, you know, when the document was edited, who edited it, what computers it was saved on. And in that case, they went through a whole round of e-discovery, you know, paid for all the experts, paid for those experts to custody the data, and then it was originally produced in PDF or a similar type of format, and then they came back around and requested everything be produced again in native format so that they could see all the metadata. And in that case, the court said, you know, you're out of luck. You should have done it the first time around. We're not going to make the opposing party pay all that cost and expense when you could have just asked for it to begin with.
Of course, it depends on the case, but I take it then in some instances you may be doing some discovery to find out. I mean, you don't know what you don't know. So you may need to do some discovery just to get a notion of what ESI is out there and the formats and so forth. Is that right?
Absolutely. You definitely need to build on it. And so one of the things that we suggest is using, you know, normal discovery, you know, asking in the deposition, what did the decedent have a computer? What kind of computer did he use? What kind of software was he using? And all of those questions will help you build on it so that you can target your ESI requests to the correct type of discovery that you want.
I can see where, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, your question's a good one. I mean, in many situations, let's say you represent a charity, or let's say you represent a distant relative that, you know, is provided for under the plan, but didn't really know the decedent that well. They're not going to know what devices are out there. They're not going to know what, you know, social media accounts or email addresses are out there. So, yeah, you're right on track there. I mean, you'd need to propound a set of sort of traditional discovery first so you can identify items you want to follow up on.
And I think this is, as you said, either I need to know this stuff or I need to have someone who does help me figure that out. So I guess this is where my expert or my co-counsel comes in to give me some direction on what I'm looking for.
Right, exactly. And I would say on the mean confer point too, I mean, we do have California Rule of Court on it, 3.724, that talks about meaning and conferring on ESI. And I just want to highlight how important it is from a cost standpoint to try to do all of this by agreement with opposing counsel. I've had many cases where I can just pick up the phone, call opposing counsel, and we say, hey, you know, let's identify the items where we actually need ESI. And then perhaps on other items we don't need the ESI, and try to get an agreement, you know, talk about keyword searches and things like that, and just try to set at the beginning of the case a framework for how the ESI is going to work. So much more efficient than, you know, trying to do this by motion or fighting over it, et cetera. I mean, not unlike any other discovery dispute, always better to try to work it out with opposing counsel. But here, where you're involving third-party experts, where you're potentially getting things loaded onto e-discovery platforms and that sort of thing, there's an extra layer of cost. And so if you can be deliberate on the front end dealing with opposing counsel through meet and confer efforts, it's going to pay dividends in terms of you know, keeping the cost down over the life of the case.
Suppose I have a case where there's a cell phone involved. I think there's important information on it that I'd like to be able to get at. What's the best way of me having access to that? I'm the requesting party. And then also cover on the responding party side, that cell phone's got a lot of personal information. So how do we make sure that only the relevant information actually gets transmitted to the propounding party?
So the way that's commonly handled, or at least the most efficient way to handle it, would be if you are cooperating with opposing counsel, it would be to come up with a protocol for handling that device where you would hand it over to a third-party forensic ESI expert. And that person would then image the phone, meaning create a digital copy of the data that's on the phone. Once that's done and everyone knows that, okay, the decedent's phone is now preserved in its original state and that data can't be tampered with, then what you can do is work with your opposing counsel to identify the scope of data that will then be made available for inspection. And so you could meet and confer on file types, date ranges, senders, recipients for emails, that sort of thing, and pare down the data that's going to be made available to both sides. Once you have that agreement on what, you know, the scope of the data that's going to be inspected, then what you can do is upload the data that's been agreed on to an e-discovery platform like a Disco or a Relativity, and then each side can search that data through those platforms in the normal course, looking for what they, you know, think might be relevant to the case. So both sides would have an independent ability to inspect that data on their own. The other thing you can do where appropriate is you can go one step further and say, okay, now that the phone's been imaged, let's actually let both sides have their independent expert take possession of the phone and inspect the physical phone. So, you know, you can reach an agreement on that as well, where both sides would have the ability to do that. But first things first, you'd want to, you know, make an image of the phone so that you preserve the data as it existed before people start tinkering with it. And if you can't do all of that by agreement, you can try to do some version of that by motion with the court. But obviously that's, you know, not the preferable route, and courts aren't going to want to be wading into ESI discovery disputes. Much better if you can work it out with counsel.
And Herb, I think you touched on an important point there, which is just because you can request electronically stored information doesn't mean that you're necessarily entitled to all of it. The same concerns that exist regarding invasion of privacy and privilege also exist in e-discovery, and in a lot of ways are really heightened because of the pervasive and expansive nature of how electronic information is stored. And so if you want to compel someone to produce these kinds of vast volumes of information, like something that you would get on a phone, the burden is going to be on you to provide a protocol to the court that shows that you're going to protect this non-relevant and or privileged information.
Suppose I have a case where we've got a decedent who's cranking out emails for years. I mean, maybe we've got a long time period, 5 or 10 years between amendments and things, and or there's undue influence issues, and so we want to really look at decedent's email account and the emails exchanged. So, you know, maybe we've got thousands of emails. You talked a little bit about keyword searches. How do we pare that down so that we don't have ourselves or our paralegal trying to read every one of these things, not only for what's relevant, but just to figure out, you know, what's going on there? What technology, what's out there to kind of help with those searches?
One of the first things that you can do is to be, like Matt said, to request those emails in their native format. And so that's going to allow you to sort the emails in ways that you wouldn't be able to if it's just in a paper copy or in a PDF. You know, we can sort by sender, we can sort by date, we can sort by attachment, just like you could in your regular email inbox. And that alone is going to be able to assist you in a lot more. But Matt's going to talk about some of the other options that are available.
Well, the other thing too is just in terms of paring down the emails to be searched. Certainly had cases where you had over 100,000 emails that were on the table, and you really don't want to be reviewing every one of those. So yeah, if you've got cooperation with opposing counsel and you can meet and confer on a list of search terms, then that's the best way to do it. And you could say, hey, here are the 30 or 50 terms that I'm going to search. And if I get hits on those terms, then those are going to be considered ones that I need to look through, but I don't have to look for things that don't come back as a hit. Because if you got a decedent's email account and you're looking at, let's say, 5 or 10 year span, and there's a lot of emails in and out of there, you don't want to be reviewing all of sort of the promotional emails, the completely extraneous emails, and the best way to get rid of those is agreeing on a set of search terms with opposing counsel. Once you have that agreement, what I usually do, and you know, I don't think you'd have to use this step, but I have an ESI consultant that I work with on a lot of my matters, that and this person knows all of the e-discovery platforms, so I don't really care which one we happen to be using at that time. But what I'll have that person do is take the emails, filter them through the agreed upon search terms that I've met and conferred with my opposing counsel on, and then he will, on one of those platforms, then create a separate sort of bucket of, you know, here are the emails that now your team needs to review. And then we can do the cool things that Scott was talking about, where now you want to drill down and isolate by sender recipient, isolate by date range, that sort of thing. You know, these e-discovery platforms, really cool. I mean, they can give you graphics that show the frequency with which the decedent was emailing a certain family member, which can be pretty compelling when you're trying to evaluate the nature of a relationship for something like an undue influence case. And you never know what you're going to find in there. I mean, I found a set of emails one time when going through this exercise to a decedent that was sent from someone that kept referring to the decedent as uncle. This person kept referring to himself as nephew in the emails. Well, this decedent's estate was going to pass by intestacy to some really distant relatives, all of whom would have been cut off in the intestacy chain if this was actually a nephew. So no one knew about this person. Huh. And so I was able to get the person on the phone pretty quickly, talk to the person, and found out that actually he wasn't a blood relative, that he and the decedent just kind of referred to each other as uncle nephew. But I mean, if it had been, you know, he was actually a nephew, then we would have discovered a major fact by going through this exercise that would have completely changed the landscape of that case. So you never know what you're going to find when you kind of start digging through the decedent's emails.
Yeah, I was intrigued too. Your article mentions the use of artificial intelligence in doing some of this searching. How does that come into play?
These e-discovery platforms, the main ones that people use, I think all or nearly all of them have the ability to do predictive coding, or TAR, technology assisted review, where it's basically AI or machine learning taking a sample of your documents that you reviewed for responsiveness and privilege and things like that, and you populate that sample into the software's sort of algorithm, it can see a pattern in what you tagged as responsive and, you know, whatever your other tags are. And then once it has a sufficient sample set, the software can then apply that pattern to the remaining, you know, the balance of the documents that you need to search. And in theory, if you gave the software a sufficient sample size such that it identified the correct patterns, the software could then just go and apply those patterns to, you know, a massive document review for you and spit out what it deems to be responsive, privileged, et cetera, and save the attorney a ton of time. I will confess that although I have played around with that technology and I have, you know, messed with it when I have a big production loaded onto an e-discovery platform, I'm still a little too uneasy to rely on it solely for document review. So I do not use that feature and just rely on the computer to do document review, even though when I've done little samples and tests with it, it seems to be really accurate. I've just not gotten to that comfort level yet. I think the technology exists, but it's just up to the attorney on whether you really want to use that and really want to go all the way to relying on it exclusively, meaning not have an attorney actually lay eyes on some of the documents that you consider reviewed.
It's a fascinating topic. And like I said, I think a lot of T&E practitioners haven't got there yet, and we certainly need to. You referenced this article as part one. What are you looking at for part two? What do we expect to see there?
Part two is going to deal a lot with responding to e-discovery requests. There are specific rules in the Code of Civil Procedure that deal with who is responsible for the payment of costs, and there are cost-shifting provisions. There are also other remedial measures like motions to compel, protective orders, and issues like that we're going to discuss in part two.
Again, you know, great article, guys. I thought it was very helpful. For our listeners, if you haven't sent out an evidence preservation letter, if you haven't had an e-discovery meet and confer, you really need to read this article. It'll show you how important this area of the law is in both the protecting a client and representing a client on both sides. Guys, I really appreciate it. Scott, if someone wants to contact you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
The best way is to email me, saf@cbsrlaw.com.
And Matt, how about you?
Yeah, all of my contact information is available on the Weathers website at weathersworldwide.com. You can navigate to my page there or just shoot me an email at matthew.owens@weathersworldwide.com.
Well, thanks, guys. I really appreciate your time. The article is great. I think people get a lot out of it. And I appreciate you explaining another area of the law that I'm apparently not competent to practice in. So thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us, Herb.
Thanks for having us, Herb.
Bye-bye.
Trust Me is a production of the Trusts and Estates section of the California Lawyers Association and produced by Foley Mara Studios. For further information, please go to calawyers.org. Click on Sections, Trusts and Estates, and look for the Education tab to learn about upcoming live programs, online CLE and webcasts, as well as a broad range of low-cost self-study programs. Many of our guests are contributors to the Trusts and Estates Quarterly, the official publication of the section. Benefits of membership include the quarterly, along with email case alerts and other opportunities to stay current in the trusts and estates field. Please consider subscribing to this podcast so that you don't miss our next episode. And thanks for listening to Trust Me.